Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call, sputtering out, something that's only happened 4 times in Tesla's history, just happened again. Race against time. Will TikTok's fate be sealed by the Senate tomorrow? We have a preview. Full steam ahead, a massive high-speed rail breaking ground. Finally, will you get your money's worth? Call it salt on the table. President Biden raising fresh questions around the prospects of tax hikes for everyone. Nail. Is a surge in rates slamming the door on one of the hottest sectors of the market? And it's a mini-sized Make It Mondays with the entrepreneur raking in big dough on tiny homes. All that and more over the hour. Belly up or buckle up. Last Call is up right now. Hi, everybody. Good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I'm Brian Sullivan. We have all that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, it was a good day for your money. Stocks ripping higher ahead of a busy week. The Dow up 250. S&P snapping its worst daily losing streak in nearly a year and a half. But it was the NASDAQ that led the way as big tech stocks bounced back. And hallelujah, NVIDIA recovered from its worst week in more than a year and a half. Amazon and Alphabet saw nice pops. Apple closing in the green after Bank of America called the stock a top pick for the rest of the year. But alas, Tesla, the one Mag 7 stock to finish the day in the red. We will have more on that later on in the show. Now, all of this happening ahead of what some may consider a make or break week for the market. That is not our opinion or the usual TV hyperbole. More than 30% of the S&P 500 reporting their earnings this week, including the aforementioned Tesla, Meta, Alphabet, Microsoft, and like 100 other companies I don't have time to name. If that was not enough, investors will get a look at key economic data that could determine how many, if any, rate cuts the Fed will make this year. Bottom line, this is a crucial week for Wall Street and your money. So after today, would you look back and maybe wish you had bought the dip last week? Or was this just like a nice pop in a market that's set to go down more? Let's talk about that with our leadoff panel. Joining us, Carson Group Chief Market Strategist Ryan Dietrich and Solus Alternative Asset Management Chief Strategist Dan Greenhouse on set. Dan, to you, I know we're panicking over like a 4% drop, but hey, it's the first one we've had in a long time. What's the macro take right now?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything to worry about right now. We had a huge rally off the low in October. Call it 20, 25% off the low. And I think that some consolidation, we've gotten somewhat overbought, some consolidation in the face of the interest rate story that developed with the Fed shouldn't be too surprising. Frankly, I thought we probably could have gone 6 or 7%. So I don't think we should fret too much about a 5.5% rally, again, especially in the context of what we experienced.
Yeah, Ryan, you've been long, you've been strong, and you've been right. What's your take about right now?
Yeah, Sully, thanks for having me, and happy Passover to all those celebrating tonight. So I agree with Dan. I mean, we had a 27.5% rally off. It was October 27th lows. Then we had a 5% correction, right? We've had a mild correction, I should say. We had a couple of those last year. Most years see those. What really fascinated me, though, was the action last week. You look at, like, new monthly lows on the S&P. Keep this real simple. Tuesday was when we saw the most. So even though the market went down Wednesday, Thursday, and obviously on Friday, we saw less monthly new lows. On Friday, this might be an RBI for you, over 330 stocks were up on Friday, and the S&P lost almost 1%. Brian, I've got data back to 1998. That only happened once, okay, where you saw that many stocks up, but the stock market down 1%. It was October 20. Last I checked, didn't do all that badly. So put a bow on this. Even though we were down last week, there was really some improvement under the surface, and we think we're trying to carve out a low. We don't think we're going to have a 10% correction. You know, I think, you know, 5 to 8% makes a lot of sense here, and, probably people are going to wish they bought when they look back 6 months from now.
Would have made a great RBI had I known that prior to the program, but I did not. So we have a different one coming up. Very quickly then, how did that happen? If 330 out of 500, which I'm not a math whiz, but that tells me it's more than half, go up, is it because only like 10 stocks actually matter for the fate of the S&P 500?
Yeah, make it real quick. Absolutely. I mean, the video is down 10%. We saw, obviously, semiconductors were crushed. I mean, you look under the surface again. What I mean, regional banks, that's all you looked at last week. And I know you need to look at more than that. They did great last week, right? So there was a lot of participation to the upside last week. It was tech was kind of masking things. And again, that's what we've seen at major lows before. So we think it's happening again.
No, I think Ryan's exactly right about a lot of that. You know, you just referred to the stocks that matter, the only stocks that matter.
I'm being a little bit facetious, but not entirely.
Yes, that's right, not entirely. But the truth is, listen, those large stocks have a huge weighting in the market, and there's no doubt that they have an outsized impact on the market. But to Ryan's point, when you look under the surface, beyond those big stocks, both on the way up and on the way down, there's all sorts of sectors and industries that are doing just fine, for lack of a better word. Obviously, we're having a bit of a correction right here, and it's a little more broad-based than some people might suggest. But at the end of the day, the economy's holding up, profits are doing okay, and as long as nothing goes wrong on the inflation front, the bias still remains to the upside because of that.
To hone in on that point, all right, if 490 stocks go up, but 10, the big 10, right, go down, I think the market overall, because of weighting, probably goes down. My guess is, Dan, that inside those 490 other names are some amazing companies that are going to make people a lot of money over the next decade, maybe more money than Amazon or Nvidia or Apple even. But it's like a honey badger market. Nobody gives a.
Well, no, I disagree. That's not true at all. I mean, listen, we spend our time talking.
You disagree with my opinion.
We're trying to make a TV show
That's
here,
true.
But we
Fair
agreed
enough.
On everything.
Let's fight.
The three of us would, but yes, those 10 stocks matter the most. Yes, they're the largest companies. Yes, each of them are 10 different companies themselves, and so they garner a lot of attention. But you know what they're not? They're not the hotels. They're not the travel companies. They're not the cruise lines. They're not the energy stocks. They're not the industrials. We talk about data center a lot through the prism of semiconductors. You know what they're not? They're not the companies that are building the data centers. They're not the companies that are cooling the data center. They're not the companies that are building the roads to the data center. There's all sorts of other business lines that are incredibly, incredibly profitable and successful, the stocks of which are doing extremely well.
Off the top of my head, a Vistra, which actually like helps build out data. I'm just pulling this out of thin air, Dan. You know why?
Totally out of thin air.
I care.
Yeah, you know what we're trying to do?
And I'm smart.
We're trying to do the viewers a favor, and that's what you're doing.
But that's why you go to the second derivative stocks, right? Everybody's, Nvidia, but there's all these companies, Vistra, whatever,
that
have to. Somebody's got to build the power lines. Ryan, if you dig in to that market, like you dig into the meal, I'm not talking about the steak, I'm not talking about the entree, sort of the sides and the appetizers, any parts of the market that you like.
Yeah, I mean, we've been even weight technology all year, saying, listen, that is the overvalued part of this market. But there are some great values when we look at financials, industrials, come over here for a while, saying we like the cyclicals. We saw some leadership there all of a sudden, right? So that's positive. One more thing that's so fascinating about this 5.5% correction, look at flows, okay? We've got people like panicking the last 2 weeks, Sully, in terms of outflows from U.S. equity funds, okay? So you got the VIX spiking, you got the VIX almost in backwardation. VIX almost hit 20 on Friday. That's kind of that high that we've seen in a while. So on just a 5.5% pullback, you've got a lot of fear. Again, it doesn't mean we're at the lows, but we think we're in the neighborhood trying to carve out some pretty significant lows. And again, we don't see a 10% correction happening. We think it's more like 5-8%.
I know we got to go very quickly, Ryan. You talked about the VIX, okay? We had Iran try to strike Israel. Israel struck Iran, actually didn't get a lot of attention, but basically a U.S. base got hit or tried to get hit in Syria today. I mean, like the Middle East is on the verge of being inflamed and the VIX is at 17.
Well, you're right. I guess it's options market way of saying it's not buying it yet, right? And real quickly, we looked at 40 major geopolitical events, Brian. You know, 3 months later, S&P is higher on average. We're not minimizing at all what's happening. But if the economy's strong, like Dan just pointed out, and I agree with, you can make up for a lot of sins over there. But let's hope calmer heads prevail, obviously.
Yeah, certainly. VIX at 17. Ryan Dietrich, thank you. Dan Greenhouse, thank you as much. Have a nice, happy sailing tonight.
Thank you, sir.
Absolutely.
All the best to you and your family.
It's time for the wine.
It always is.
It always is, right? Right at 8:01. Guys, thank you. All right. We hope it's 8:01. Let's check out what happened inside the market. Your stud and dud, the big winner of the day. Look at that, the blue oval. You go, Dearborn, up 6%. Maybe because of Tesla's price cuts. Again, we'll get more on cars a little bit later on. The big decliner, Cardinal Health, flew the coop, down 5%. After it ended a partnership with United Health, quick check on futures, mixed trade, very thin. All right, let's move on. We are just getting started. On deck here on Last Call, against the clock. Can TikTok pull a rabbit, a legislative rabbit, out of the hat in the Senate tomorrow? Or is it really game over for the beloved, by some, app? Plus, it's only happened 4 times in Tesla's entire history as a public company, and it just happened again. What that is, ahead.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Saturday, CNBC is your ticket to the annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting. Watch live on air or stream all the action at CNBC.com. Warren Buffett meets with shareholders, plus their questions, his answers. Becky Quick and Mike Santoli with full coverage from Omaha. Then re-rack the energy with highlights Monday morning starting on Squawk Box. The annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting, live on air and online, starts 9:30 Eastern, Saturday, CNBC.
All right, looking at tomorrow's news tonight, and tomorrow is a massive day for TikTok and all you out there that love it. The Senate will take an opening vote that could lead to the Chinese-owned social media app being forced to sell or even be shut down. Emily Wilkins joining us now with more from D.C. Emily, what are you hearing and reading from lawmakers ahead of the vote?
Well, Brian, TikTok is definitely on the clock tomorrow in the Senate, and lawmakers do appear likely to give this bill the green light. That, of course, would give the video app the ultimatum to either divest from parent company ByteDance or be banned in the U.S. Now, of course, a ban could boost some other social media companies trying to get in on the video game, but it could create headwinds for other groups like Oracle, which acts as the data center for U.S. TikTok users. CNBC's Brian Schwartz reports that Oracle met with Senate staffers last month, although the company did not lobby for or against the bill, certainly one of the many groups on Capitol Hill trying to get their stance known ahead of this vote. TikTok would have at least 9 months to find a buyer and could get up to a year if the president grants an extension. Now, that change has won the support of a key lawmaker, Maria Cantwell, who chairs the committee overseeing TikTok, as well as her Republican counterpart on that committee, Ted Cruz. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell also backed the bill, so a lot of bipartisanship here. And TikTok, of course, has been pushing against the bill. They spent over $4.5 million in advertisements opposing the bill, according to data from Ad Impact. CEO Shouzi Chu also said the company will exercise their legal rights if the legislation passes. Also weighing in, former President Donald Trump, who has flipped from wanting a ban to now supporting TikTok. Here's a portion of a post from his Truth Social account this afternoon. He said that President Biden was responsible for not only banning TikTok, but helping Facebook, quote, become richer and more dominant, which he alleges would be bad for Republicans. The Senate will be taking the initial vote on the bill tomorrow, and final passage could come as soon as then as well. Lawmakers really want to get this done, and Brian will be watching closely.
Well, I'll tell you what, Emily. I mean, you can't predict what's going to happen. Let's say it passes the Senate and it goes to the president's desk. I mean, I would imagine that the odds of a veto are high, because if my name is Biden, I need the young vote. And shutting down TikTok and angering millions and millions of voters, probably not the best election strategy.
Well, Brian, that's been one of the most interesting things about this. I mean, election-wise, Biden has really tried to court younger voters. He's invited TikTok influencers to the White House, and yet he says that he would support this bill if it got to his desk. It's this weird contradiction here that I think can be summed up with most lawmakers saying, look, it's not that we want to ban TikTok. We're totally fine with TikTok. Our concern is the tie that TikTok has to ByteDance and the tie that ByteDance has to the Chinese Communist Party, yeah, and how that could potentially be a national security risk. That's really what's at the heart of this entire debate.
That pesky algorithm pushing things to what our kids and teens and even us see. Emily Wilkins, Big Day Tomorrow. Thank you. All right, let's talk more now about this. Joining us, Raymond James, Washington policy analyst Ed Mills, had a great note out on this morning. And The Verge editor-in-chief and CNBC contributor Nilay Patel. Nilay, I want to kick it off with you. Okay, so this is a little weird. According to prediction market Kalshi, right, where you can bet on stuff, current odds are that this bill, the ban bill, has a 97% chance of passing. But in terms of the odds of the app actually shutting down or getting banned, 88% of Kalshi bettors say TikTok will not be banned in America this year. Can you square those things for us? I can't.
I can give it a shot. I don't know what Kalshi's going to say about how well I'm going to do, but I can give it a shot. Biden's not going to veto this bill, right? Vetoing this bill means vetoing aid for Ukraine and Israel, which I don't think he's likely to do. That's why it's being packaged up in this bill. So he's going to pass. If the bill passes tomorrow, I expect it will be passed by dinner time tomorrow. Biden will sign the bill. We'll enter into that 9 month to a year period where TikTok becomes one of the richest prizes in all of tech and media. Right. It is a scaled social platform that both Meta and Google, in terms of YouTube, are deeply afraid of. There are a lot of players that would love to compete for the dollars that Meta and Google can pull from their social platforms and have no way of scaling their way to do it. So you can see just the ecosystem of players that will either try to raise money to buy TikTok, that might have the money themselves in terms of Microsoft or even Apple, which seems like a long shot, or try to syndicate the money. You can see a Snap try to build a syndicate to buy TikTok. So there's a lot of players that see this prize.
And Ed Nalay nailed it. He put it in a political way where this was stuffed into a funding bill for things the president really, really wants, primarily more funding for Ukraine. So the president cannot veto this bill. I would imagine that was part of the strategy for those who are looking to shut down or force a sale of TikTok.
Yeah, so in D.C., things seem impossible right up until the moment it's inevitable. And so once this was added on to the bills last week, this becomes inevitable. To your question on whether or not it's happening this year or next year, I'd probably take next year. There will be legal challenges to this, Brian. But when you read the text of the bill, what's really interesting is they don't want TikTok to have the ability to judicial shop this around and get a favorable judge. Congress is judicial shopping and putting it in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, the most likely court to side with Congress, to side with the president, and allow this forced divestiture to go forward. And what Raymond James clients are asking me is, will China allow this? I know there's a lot of potential buyers out there. This is a really great property. But if you give that algorithm to a U.S.-based corporation, then we're going to get to see exactly what they're going to do with it. It's not so much about the news stories we're seeing, but it is the collection of personally identifiable information. It is the building out of a LLM AI model with that data. There is a number of national security concerns here that makes it very likely, in my opinion, come next year, TikTok, as we know it, will not operate here in the United States.
Nilay, it's an excellent point again. Do you agree with that? Like China, you can't force them to sell anything. They could just shut it down because my guess is, to Ed's point, they don't really want you to know what's under the hood here.
Yeah, you know, China and ByteDance, they've had this deal with Oracle for quite some time. Project Texas. It turns out Project Texas is kind of a sham, right? I mean, that's all the reporting that's come out recently. I think what's more likely is they say, okay, you can have the user base, you can have the data. We're going to keep the recommendation algorithm to ourselves. There are only a handful of things that overcome the First Amendment in this country. Pornography is one of them. The things that Congress can legislate and regulate directly. There's a really small handful of things. Foreign media ownership is actually one of them. We have rules in this country about how much media foreign countries are able to own. We actually have rules about how much any one citizen is able to own. Concentration of media ownership, also a threat to democracy in this country, long since recognized. So I think you're going to see those challenges. You'll hear ByteDance make a lot of noise about the First Amendment, and you're going to see Congress and the government say, look, there are long-standing rules about foreign media ownership in this country. This is the most important media we have going. We're just going to apply the rule.
Yeah, the First Amendment argument to me, again, not a lawyer, have a law degree, just seems a little bit specious, a little bit weird, given that you are an adversary country to many people. Nilay Patel, always put the X in the center square. I like your background. Ed Mills, Raymond James, guys, really appreciate it to you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, are tax hikes coming for you and you and you? Some interesting comments from the president on just that you may not have heard, but you will after this.
Saturday, CNBC is your ticket to the annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting. Watch live on air or stream all the action at CNBC.com. Warren Buffett meets with shareholders, plus their questions, his answers. Becky Quick and Mike Santoli with full coverage from Omaha. Then re-rack the energy with highlights Monday morning starting on Squawk Box. The annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting, live on air and online, starts 9:30 Eastern, Saturday, CNBC.
Let's talk everybody's least favorite topic. How's that? We're just going to reel in the viewers now. We're going to talk taxes. Because something fairly remarkable happened on Friday that got almost no attention anywhere else. I tweeted about it. The president said that starting in 2026, taxes on everyone, all of you, may go up. He was speaking at the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Conference. The president referenced the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that lowered everybody's top-end rate, middle class, lower income, higher, whatever, by 2%. But that act is set to expire at the end of next year. And the president very clearly said, if he's reelected, he will let the entire act expire. Listen.
My predecessor rolled back protection for American workers. He opposed increases in federal minimum wage. And he was proud, very proud of his $2 trillion tax cut when he was president that overwhelmingly benefited the wealthy and created the biggest corporations. By the way, this is there's no exaggeration here. It's going to expire. And if I'm reelected, it's going to stay expired.
So letting that act expire would raise all of your top-line tax rates, everybody out there listening and watching, by 2%. It would also raise corporate taxes back to a max of 35% from the current 21%. Now, to be fair, because we're fair, the White House tried to correct the president over the weekend, saying that what he meant to say was that he would only let taxes for families making more than $400,000 per year go up. That's in line with his current budget proposals. But it's not what the president said. You heard him. He's very clear. He never mentioned income limits in the speech. Now, if you're a heavily taxed blue state resident, this expiration would actually be really good news because, yeah, your top end rate's going to go up by 2%, but it would also end the cap on state and local tax deductions because millions of families in high tax areas around, as you found out, those 2017 tax quote cuts were actually tax hikes in disguise. It's why I labeled it the blue state payback at the time. So should Biden let this whole thing expire, roll back the SALT deductions, and benefit a few upper-income folks in blue states? Let's talk about it now. Joining us, former senior aide to the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, Melissa DeRosa. And I presume that you will say what the president directly said to a camera reading a script that somebody, he read a script. He didn't say anything about 400,000. He said, I'm going to let them expire. I presume you're going to side with the White House communications person, anonymous person who said later on, that's not what he meant.
Well, look, the White House has since attempted to clean that up. He was in front
of... So like some anonymous comms person has to correct the president.
Right. But, you know, the same way that Trump goes out and mistakes Nancy Pelosi for Nikki Haley or whomever he's talking about that day. But look, he was speaking to... But he was, and he misspoke all the time then, too.
Sure.
You know,
call
saying things
then.
Like you should put inject bleach to get rid of COVID. But what happened here was the president was in front of a large union audience. He was playing to the populist parts of his agenda, which includes rolling back many of the Trump-era giveaways to corporations and to the wealthy. So, yes, he misspoke. He wasn't precise in what he was saying, but what he was attempting to say is that when those tax cuts expire, he's going to make changes, including rolling back the corporate tax cut, including letting some of those higher income taxes get reduced and put more money into things like the child care tax.
But what I'm OK, so he read a speech that somebody else probably wrote And they just left that part out. And by the way, if you're going to be populist, you know what you do to the union guys? You say it's only for rich people. You make sure that's in there, because if you listen to like the smattering of applause, they're probably all looking around going, wait, what?
Look, it was no doubt imprecise, but I think that the president has been very clear on where he is on taxes, which includes keeping the tax cuts that went to families earning $400,000 or less.
But I want to make something clear, and maybe you're not. Some people in this room would know this personally. Those, quote, tax cuts, and I'm doing the air quotes if you're listening on the radio, for the wealthy, lowered your top end. But if you live in New Jersey, New York, parts of, you know, California, maybe in Wilmette, Illinois, you got a tax hike.
Yep.
Because capping that, we've talked about it,
yep,
capping that deduction on state and local taxes, even with AMT, I can just speak out of personal experience, was a gigantic tax increase.
Look, Brian.
So I would love it. By the way, I hope the president is right. Let him expire.
Look, and it's going to expire. The SALT deductions, SALT caps are going to expire, and it's going to force everyone back to the table. Unfortunately for people from New York, New Jersey, California, I'm not sure that there's a lot of political will to let SALT deductions, the caps, go away altogether and let it go back to the good old days. Because there's just, on the left,
because if you did that, you would effectively, in many, not all cases, lower upper income and wealthy people's taxes.
But see,
you,
Brian, you're making the wrong argument. You would for upper income people, but it's also middle class people. In states like New York, you've got twice as many people that file that have a SALT deduction that's higher than that $10,000 cap than don't. 52 of the 62 counties have people who file taxes that exceed that $10,000 cap. So this is not about the super wealthy. This is about the middle class.
I need you to do something for me. Watch the show every night, because we've talked about this, and I've said this before, and people in Iowa listening or watching, they're like, what are you talking about? I'm going to look at the camera and say this. If you're a family with an accountant and a police officer, you itemize more than 10 grand. I'm just telling you, an average home in New Jersey could have 20,000 in property taxes. You're paying 30,000 in state income tax.
Yep.
And these are not millionaires and billionaires.
Not even close.
Right. So I've made that point.
Yeah. And look, the thing is that let me do a quick history lesson,
okay,
not to bore you.
Yes, Professor.
But Lincoln does the first federal income tax in the 1860s to pay for the Civil War. And what did he do when he did that? That's when they started state and local tax deductibility, because at the time, the federal government said, we're not going to do double taxation. That held intact all the way up until 2017 when Trump did his tax proposal.
Yeah.
In the 80s, Reagan attempted to get rid of SALT, and then he ended up being swayed by his own congressional delegation because he knew it was going to hurt the people of California.
Because he was a rich Californian, and his friends are rich Californians, and they got whacked.
Stop,
very
you're
quickly,
not on
and
message.
We got to go,
middle
but I got to get this out.
Middle class.
Okay, but how do they do this? The president said, don't kill the music. I'm not done. All right, there we go. We'll cut something out. Kill the RBI later. That's called producing from the set.
Don't
quickly
put baby in the corner.
If it goes, if it expires, president, as he said, 400,000. You can't do that. You can't just carve it out. It will have to expire, and they're going to have to start over make a new act.
That's
so
right.
You can't just carve out the $400,000, can you?
No, you're going to have to start over. Exactly right.
The president was right.
But he intends to keep the cuts under 400,000.
But he's going to have to restart it, which will probably at least be a year, and then taxes will go up in the interim.
Well, we'll see. Taxpayers don't like to have their tax cuts rolled back, and so suddenly you've got a lot of momentum and reason to get people to the table.
Wait, what? People don't like their tax cuts to be rolled back?
Not the people I know.
This show is not only interesting, it's informative.
That's right.
We now, music. That's how it works. I'm in trouble. All right, coming up, stuck in a rut. It's only happened 4 times in Tesla's history, and it just happened again. What it is, coming up. They kept the RBI. Time now for your Monday RBI. Today we're talking about sports, but not baseball. We're talking golf and money and the red-hot Scottie Scheffler. Masters champ Scheffler just won again, taking home the title at the RBC Heritage. And if you're not a golf fan, you may not know this, but Scheffler has been on an insane run. He's now won 4 of the last 5 golf tournaments. All those wins made Scheffler a lot of green, as of course well as the green jacket. Listen to this. In just the last 44 days, Scheffler has won over $16 million in prize money. Do the math, carry the 1, divide by 2. That comes out to $368,000 per day over the last 44 days. For a little perspective, Scheffler took home more money in just 6 weeks than NFL superstar Travis Kelce made in all of last year. And next month, Scheffler could get a whole lot richer. PGA Championship tees off at Valhalla Golf Club in Louisville, Kentucky. The winner gets paid more than $3 million. With the way that Scheffler's playing right now, I mean, can anybody else win? He'll probably take home another big check, one of the most insane runs in golf history. Random, but interesting. All right, now, maybe we call this the opposite of Scheffler, from a stock perspective anyway, because it's been a very rough run lately for Tesla shareholders. Stock closed down just over 3% today. And that is Tesla's seventh down session in a row, tying it for its longest losing streak in history. So if it goes down tomorrow, it will be an ignominious new record. But even if you don't own Tesla, you don't drive a Tesla, you don't care about Elon Musk, maybe you should care about Tesla stock. It could be very important for the market. Here's why we say that. Tesla has 3.18 billion shares outstanding. It's in over 350 ETFs. It's got huge options activity, and it's also used in all kinds of derivative trades on Wall Street, things you've probably never heard about, like Delta One strategies, etc. The bottom line is Tesla is a very important stock. And let's be fair, because again, that's what we do here on Last Call. Tesla, even with the recent woes, has still made a lot of investors a lot of money. The stock was only 15 bucks a couple of years ago. So if you bought it then, even with the downslide, you've done very well. But let's talk more about Tesla, its importance to the market, and maybe where all the EV makers are going to be headed, because Tesla reports numbers tomorrow. Joining us now with more is Tesla investor and ARK Invest Director of Investment Analysis, Tasha Keeney. Tasha, thanks for coming on again. There's two ways to look at Tesla. A, it's been a massive moneymaker for millions of investors over the last decade. Or two, in the last couple months, it's not been. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think, at ARK Invest, we're long-term investors and we care about disruptive innovation. So, you know, as you said, Tesla is important to the equity market. You know, I'd say it's important to the world at large. I mean, it's single-handedly pushed forward the electric vehicle industry. I think it's going to do the same for autonomous driving. So that's what we're focused on, that long-term story. And I think that given the recent price action, you know, it really suggests that investors are ignoring what I believe will be a massive opportunity in the robo-taxi network. And I think that's pretty short-sighted.
What's wrong with Tesla stock? You guys do great work, great analysis there. You got a $2,000 price target on the stock. It's a lot higher than it is now. What's wrong with the stock, Tasha?
Well, I think investors are concerned about demand for electric vehicles, demand for Tesla specifically. You know, they're looking at this year's numbers versus last year at, you know, the current growth rate of deliveries. Of course, deliveries did disappoint relative to expectations this past quarter. But I think what they should be focused on is let's zoom out and look at electric vehicles as a whole. They are now price competitive with gas-powered cars in many ways, thanks to Tesla. And so Tesla is a leader in that industry, and that story is not going to change. So when I think of the auto industry as a whole, you know, Tesla's not immune to interest rates. I don't expect them to be. We heard that they're in between growth curves on the last earnings call. I wouldn't be surprised about some short-term upsets, but I think the long-term story is electric vehicles are here to stay. Tesla's prices are so competitive, it's going to be very hard for any other company to catch up to them at this point, particularly in the U.S. market. And on software and autonomy, I mean, I think they have a data advantage that is unparalleled.
But yeah, and I've said people don't want electric cars, they want Teslas. I've driven all of them. It's a totally different thing. Does a Cybertruck matter to Tesla? I mean, it's a niche vehicle, got a lot of hype, right? They had a recall, right? There's some pedal issues and whatever, they'll fix that. Does a Cybertruck matter to Tesla stock at all?
Yeah, you know, I'd agree with you in terms of, you know, sort of the short-term thinking around the Cybertruck. You know, I think we actually thought the Cybertruck would be bigger than it was. You know, it turns out they had some, it was harder to manufacture than Tesla thought. So I think, you know, given the price point, you know, it'll stay at like, not necessarily a niche car, but certainly lower volumes than we were expecting. But I think what really matters to Tesla, again, it's robotaxis, it's the long-term picture for autonomy. So I'm really excited to hear about what Elon has to say in the earnings call. He's been teasing us all with his Twitter responses about what he thinks that their full self-driving software might be capable of, you know, in the next months to say year or so, and what markets they might enter. And we also have the robotaxi event unveil in August this year, of course. So that's, you know, Tesla's dedicating manufacturing resources to this platform. I think that shows their confidence.
Tosh Keeney, ARK Invest, big position. And you're right, tomorrow, big day for you, your investors, and Tesla investors. Thank you. All right, coming up, is it just the ticket? A massive high-speed rail breaking ground, finally. But if you build it, does that mean people will come? The journey from Southern California, Rancho Cucamonga to be exact, to Las Vegas will soon be cut in half thanks to a new high-speed rail project. The privately owned Brightline West broke ground today. It'll reach a top speed of about 200 miles an hour, an actual high-speed rail in America. It'll run across a 218-mile route between Las Vegas and three California stops. Project received $3 billion from the Federal Infrastructure Act. Morgan Brennan just sat down with billionaire investor Wes Edens. His Fortress Investment Group owns Brightline West, and she joins us now from a room with a very white background. Morgan Brennan, hi.
Hi. Well, I'll just let you know this is like my son's background, so Anyway, yes, this is a milestone. Brightline West is poised to become America's first ever high-speed passenger railroad. It's the world's first green bullet train. It would be fully electric, powered by renewables as well. But for Wes Edens, who is the founder of Brightline, this lays the groundwork not only for faster, easier travel between Southern California and Vegas, but for a business model to be replicated between other cities across the U.S. as well.
The ones that are most obvious are the Texas routes, right? So there's been a lot of chat about that. So, you know, Dallas, Houston, Houston to San Antonio, San Antonio, Austin up to Dallas. So that's an obvious one. Atlanta, Charlotte is a great one. I think, from Portland to Seattle. There's a lot of people that are talking about it. And I think that proof of concept of one system can really then galvanize that and turn those into deals. So we haven't really sat down hard yet and approached it. We've been very, very focused on getting this one off the ground, so to speak. But when this is actually now under construction fully, those are all markets we're going to spend real time in, and I'm sure we'll find other opportunities.
So for Edens and Fortress, it all started in Florida. Brightline there is actually the first and only privately owned passenger railroad in the country. It's not high speed, but they've seen ridership balloon into the millions annually. It helps set the standard. It's made it easier for Brightline West to win $3 billion in federal funding and now turn to the debt markets for majority of capital for the what's expected to be $12 billion project. To achieve profitability, which has been elusive for U.S. passenger rail, with the exception perhaps of Amtrak's Northeast Corridor, it's going to come down to ridership and ticket price. There's about 50 million trips that happen between L.A. and Vegas, 85% by car. Edens calls it a, quote, very compelling opportunity, noting that there are intercity high-speed rail systems that are highly profitable around the world. The key question here, Brian, is going to be, are riders going to get on board? And is this thing going to open by 2028 in time for the Olympics, which is the current plan?
Well, California has a terrible history of high-speed rail. Listen, I'm a huge high-speed rail fan. You probably are, too. Travel all over the world. Everywhere I go, I ride it. Give it a chance. People are skeptical. You walk in, you sit down, there's leg room, it's fast. And I'll tell you why it will succeed. Number one, it's privately run. So I think that's going to make it a lot easier. And you know what the one-word answer is, Morgan, of why I think the Brightline West will succeed? What's the one-word answer?
I don't know what.
Booze. You can start drinking. You don't have to wait to get to Vegas, right? You're going for some big weekend with your buddies. You got whatever going on. You can get on the train, probably have a cocktail, buckle up, belly up, or somebody. That's a tagline of a show.
Yeah, that's right. And you can do this all without sitting in traffic and potentially half the time it would take to go by car. So that is sort of the key to this. And to your point, Brian, I mean, we have seen other high-speed rail projects that have been stalled. There's a very high-profile public sector one in California, actually, or even scrapped. So we're poised to potentially make history here if this moves forward. And it's certainly been many, many decades in the making. The fact that it's all electric is going to be very fascinating to watch how that plays out, too.
Yep, rooting for it. And I love the high-speed rail. We get one from New York to Chicago, 5 or 6 hours, couple of stops. You're comfortable. Did I mention legroom? Morgan Brennan, great stuff.
Legroom, cocktails.
Legroom. What else do you need besides the Morgan Brennan hard hat that I threw on the other day? Right?
No, I think you're all set. And then just you sitting there, you can entertain everybody. You'll just talk the entire time.
And what we also learned is that Morgan Brennan's child has apparently their own home TV studio.
No, I just camped out here. He's late to bed.
I like it. Yes. Morgan Brennan, great story. Look forward to hopping on hopefully in a couple of years. Morgan, thank you. All right, let's get now to our quicker than the ticker. All the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. Record-breaking rain in southern China. Tens of thousands have been evacuated from the Guangdong region so far. It's a major manufacturing area, and more than 1 million people have lost power. Delta boosting pay for non-union employees. Flight attendants and ground workers will see a 5% bump with starting wages at $19 an hour. The increases will impact more than 80,000 Delta employees. Wayfair, the e-commerce furniture and home goods store, opening its first in-person store. It will open in Wilmette, Illinois next month. It also includes an on-site restaurant along with home decor, furniture, and more. An ultra-rare Rolex just sold for $3.5 million over the weekend in Monaco. It is one of 12 split-seconds models produced in the 1940s. It is the fifth most expensive Rolex ever sold at auction. Sharing the wave with dolphins. Hawaiian surfer Gabriella Bryan won her first World Championship Tour event in Australia with a pod of dolphins in tow. She says it made for a, quote, magical moment. Wow. Coming up, it is Make It Mondays, and we'll meet the entrepreneur cashing in big on tiny houses. Stay with us.
Time now for our Make It Mondays. And tonight, we meet Precious Price. She built a luxury tiny home in the back of her other home in Atlanta, Georgia, to earn extra income by renting it out. It now covers all the costs for both homes, including her mortgage, bills, and apparently airfare to last call. Let's take a look at how she did it.
People are very surprised by the fact that this tiny house is less than 300 square feet, yet I have everything that I need. My name is Precious Price, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia. I built a tiny house in my backyard for about $35,000. So the initial plan for the tiny house was in the middle of the global pandemic. When I started building a tiny house, how I financed it was through my own credit cards, in addition to cashing out a few of the stocks that I had from my 9-to-5. My budget for building the tiny house was about $25,000. By the time we finished, we were over budget $10,000. After going through the build process, being over budget, behind schedule, we immediately ended up deciding to rent it on Airbnb just to recoup some of those costs pretty quickly. I love this little breakfast nook area. If I was to describe my tiny home for someone who has never been here, I would literally just describe it as a studio apartment. So immediately when you come in, you are now in the dining slash living room. I would describe the tiny house as very light, airy, open. I made sure to add a ton of windows just to open the space up. Right across from the kitchen is where we have the bathroom. There's a full shower, which is honestly perfect. And of course, once you turn around from that bathroom, you then see the library ladder, which leads up to the loft. Honestly, putting a structure in your backyard provides a ton of options, whether it's actual rental income like I've been able to do, or even, again, just like a secondary structure that you may be able to live out of yourself and then rent your primary home.
And her story is also featured in the CNBC show Unlocked, showcasing how people live and how they've turned their real estate dreams into reality. And you don't have to wait long. Unlocked airs in like 2 minutes right after this show. But Precious Price was kind enough to come up from Atlanta, Georgia, Yeah. Precious, good to see you.
It's great to see you.
I mean,
you,
is this the, first off, who's renting this Airbnb in your, like, who is your tenant that comes in and books this?
So typically I have students that are tenants in addition to young professionals. Those are usually the folks that need it. And when you think about Atlanta, there are a huge number of colleges and universities.
Are you right shocked now at how surprised and successful it's been?
Honestly, yes. You'd be surprised how many people, like, how much they were willing to pay. But on top of that, the people that were interested in actually staying in a shed in a backyard just because it's cool.
And that covers the costs of your primary home.
It covers the mortgage, yes.
Which is amazing to me.
In this market, absolutely.
Now, you got some tips, because I think your first tip is critically important.
Absolutely.
People are watching this going, oh, yeah, you know what? That's a great idea. I'm going to do it. And then they find out they can't because of zoning regulations.
Exactly. So make sure that you are checking your zoning regulations. You can give a call to your zoning office, or you can just try and look online. That's the best way.
And don't go to, like, Home Depot and buy, like, one of those pre-sheds, right? That, like, you need somebody that knows what they're doing.
You need someone that knows what they're doing, and then you also need to connect it to water and electricity. Many people don't think about that with those Home Depot sheds.
I would hope with a toilet, that would be kind of a vital thing.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's not good.
It's not going to work out.
It won't. It's... Yes. Johnny on the spot here. Also, return on investment.
Yes. So your return on investment can look like a number of things. For a lot of people, this is money, right? Whether that is renting it out on Airbnb, and now, like me, you are covering your mortgage. But for other people, it's, hey, I just want to have my aging parents closer so that they can maybe watch the kids.
Yeah, but then you can't make any money. You got to make them pay.
That's, I mean,
Make the parents pay.
You can't make your parents
pay. My parents came up this weekend. I was like, you know, I should have had that. So again, now, and you advise people, you're on, like, a board or something that's advising this tiny home movement?
So I have a startup called GatherADU.com.
Okay.
Where we help homeowners who are ready to make this happen, who are ready to leverage their extra space in their backyard to create housing for whatever you want to use it for. Our software helps with that.
What's the website?
GatherADU.com.
Okay, and that's basically set, gives kind of your tips.
Exactly.
And your experience, because I'm sure it hasn't been all super smooth.
No.
I mean, there's always problems with everything.
It's always problems. And if you want to check out those problems, I did a whole docuseries on YouTube called Going Tiny, where I was literally crying about working with contractors and everything. It was insanity. So it never
even on a 300 square foot house.
Even on a 300 square foot house.
Which apparently probably has one of the highest ROIs of any Airbnb for its size. I love it. It's free for CNBC anchors when we come to Atlanta.
Yes.
See, you're on record now. Precious Price, thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Good stuff. Congrats on your success. Thanks for watching. The aforementioned Unlocked is unlocked right now.
Saturday, CNBC is your ticket to the annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting. Watch live on air or stream all the action at CNBC.com. Warren Buffett meets with shareholders, plus their questions, his answers. Becky Quick and Mike Santoli with full coverage from Omaha. Then re-rack the energy with highlights Monday morning starting on Squawk Box. The annual Berkshire Hathaway meeting, live on air and online, starts 9:30 Eastern, Saturday, CNBC.